From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Are today's undergraduates human? By way of the title he chose for a recent article in the Harvard University Alumni Magazine, one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center poses that question. Franklin Ford served from 1962 through 1970 as Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard, where he is a professor of ancient and modern history. Joining with Franklin Ford in the discussion about American undergraduate education are William Bennett, Ernestine Friedel, and Sam Williamson. William Bennett is chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a federal agency. Ernestine Friedel is Dean of Arts and Sciences and Trinity College at Duke University, where she also serves as a professor of anthropology. Sam Williamson is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he is also a member of the Department of History. Let's begin with Franklin Ford, who wrote an article for the Harvard Alumni Magazine with the title, Are Today's Undergraduates Human? Are they human? Why would you write an article with a title like that?
Of course they are, and I'm sure that all of us here agree that they are. The point of writing the article was really to tilt a lance with what seemed to me much too prevalent stereotype against, in effect, against stereotypic thinking in general and against the particular stereotype of today's undergraduates as being materialistic, cautious, unimaginative, in short, too square to be interesting.
Where did that notion come from, stereotypes being what they are? Ernie Friedel, do you see the undergraduates at Duke in that sense at all?
I think the students are searching for warmth. They are very idealistic and unhappy because they don't believe that it's possible to maintain the ideals. So I think they're disillusioned. And they're disillusioned both about the educational process and about their friendships in the in college and the university. They want desperately to have some kind of warmth of relationship, but they feel that in order to get ahead, in order to get the grades, in order to get into the graduate schools, in order to get the kind of jobs that they want, they have to look at other people in an instrumental way instead of in a warm, friendly way. So they manipulate, and they don't like manipulating.
How does that come out in terms of education, in terms of the courses that they pick? Sam Williamson, maybe you can comment on that.
Let me pick up on Ernie's point. I think you can see it in at least three distinct ways, the first of which is the drift that began in the mid-1970s, students moving into business administration programs or economics, mm-hmm. because they saw in those areas job-related characteristics and job-related skills, which would then give them a sort of a base of security. And those schools which had schools of business administration found themselves being inundated with undergraduates and economics departments the same. There may be now a little bit of a tapering off of that phenomenon, but it's not altogether gone. It's now being replaced by a second way, which is if you have some skills with the computer, in some sort of sense, you will thus be able to guarantee the future. That will give you a little bit of an edge. A third thing I think has changed is the open access that began in the 60s for higher education for lots of students, and that's particularly true at the big state universities, has also transformed the nature of what graduate education is. In the old days, it was seen graduate education as something a few people did. More and more now, the MBA, post-BA, post-baccalaureate education is considered to be an acceptable phenomenon. The question of posing, getting oneself ready to participate in that process leads to the kind of things Ernie's talking about, because to participate, you've got to have reasonably good academic records. And though the old gentleman C has now been replaced by the gentlewoman and gentleman C, elevated for grade inflation to gentleman B or B minus, there is still some of that. And a group of maybe a third of the undergraduates go right through the whole process being relatively unaffected at all by higher education. It is the sort of the finishing school process. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of them, there's a lot of manipulation going on, just what Ernie was talking about.
Is it possible to generalize about what undergraduates today feel might be the, is there a core for them? Do they tend to take particular kinds of courses, and what do those courses lead to? I'm asking, for instance, Bill Bennett to comment on the way the attitude of undergraduates today toward courses in the liberal arts and the humanities. Has that shifted a lot, or has it stayed
It's shifted some. Yeah, I think it's already been suggested. We have seen the last 10 years a dramatic increase in the number of students who are taking what I think you'd properly call a pre-professional concentration. Large increase in the number of students, speaking now of national trends, into business administration, into accounting, into computer work, a lot of that. See, I think what I know about is essentially trends in the humanities, and therefore I don't want to speak beyond my competence. It seems to me with the question we have before us, the turn I'd put on it is that in some ways I think the institutions have changed more than the students. If we look over a 20-year pattern, Franklin Ford had a very nice line, I thought. He said, this is all I mean by suggesting that even the most laid-back college man or woman appreciates an opportunity to think, and that we presumably can offer them. I think that's right. I think that's right today. I think that's right 20 years ago. The question is, are we providing that opportunity? And this gets us into some large questions about what is the institution saying to the student about the many questions which Ernie raised. That is, what about my career? What about personal relations? What about God, nature, goodness, and truth? There, I think, we can say that the institutional posture is a little different than it was 20
how,
years
how
ago.
Is it different?
Well, again, just taking the humanities as an example, we don't have the kind of expectations that we used to have that students would study the humanities. You can look at distribution requirements, course requirements over the last 20 years, and there is a real difference in the two periods. It used to be thought at most institutions that before you got through, you had to confront and counter experience certain courses, certain books, certain questions. It's now a much more elective business. We see a number of institutions struggling with this, and the whole question of core curricula, getting back to required courses, is something that many institutions are still discussing. But there's plainly less consensus. There's plainly, I think, in most places, less confidence about this. Therefore, think of the student who comes to college with tuition as high as it is, with pressure from parents, do well, get out and get a job. Peer pressure can be the cruelest of all. You better keep your grades up. Student then says, well, I'm half inclined to take a course in philosophy. What I'm saying is there are some pressures there against the student taking that. And sometimes the institutions haven't been helpful. Again, I am not in despair about today's students. I think they're fine, and some of this career interest seems to me to be fine, appropriate. John Dewey said it's not enough to be good, you've got to be good for something. I don't have any problem with that. My question really, or my worry really, is about students achieving some minimal level of what we might call cultural literacy. And it may not be a problem at the three institutions here. These are very selective institutions. It may be that many of the students who come to Duke and Chapel Hill and Harvard already have achieved that, but a large number of students haven't. We know that from what we know about secondary schools. And if we look at the kind of patterns in most institutions, do not have this kind of assurance. I don't want to prohibit anybody from being interested in having a career and think it's an entirely appropriate interest, but I also think that before we certify them as being educated, that we have some confidence that they have some minimal grasp of what? History, philosophy, literature. And I don't think one can feel that kind of confidence.
Well, one way that you can talk about the way kids get educated is directly through the connections that they have with their professors. Let me ask you to comment on that. Franklin, do you think that undergraduates today look upon their professors differently than the way they looked on them in the 50s and the 60s? Do they look to them, for instance, for particular kinds of inspiration or leadership? What?
My guess is they still do look to them for that, but with fewer of the trappings of formal respect, certainly reverence. In general, it seems to me that the dependence of undergraduates on the faculty has in a curious way increased in the last 20 years. It's my impression that the desire to talk one-on-one with faculty seems to me stronger than it was a couple of decades ago. And what they're really asking for, and this goes back to a point that Bill raised that I wanted to pick up anyway, thinking in terms of institutional educational response, the one that I would put the highest value on and try hardest to maintain and even increase has been to shift the emphasis from a kind of cultural packaging, which was characteristic of the old general education approach coming out of the Second World War. A lot of institutions wanted to reassert our cultural heritage in the face of Nazi Germany and to some extent Stalinist Russia, with the result that the students were relatively passive and given their heritage to contemplate and treasure. Now the emphasis in practically all, and my colleagues from the local institutions can correct me if I'm wrong about them, all of the reforms I know of have been in the direction of emphasis on modes of thinking, that is, ways of attacking problems and sorting out choices with a lot of choice. Now, in our own case, essentially, this has taken the form of a required program, which no longer is like old general education with massive single package courses, but much more on different modes of thinking, experimental, historical, aesthetic, ethical, analytical. One of the implications of the ethical emphasis has been that suddenly philosophy departments, which were doing very little business with undergraduates until fairly recently, have been under great pressure, and some of them have changed a good deal.
Ernie Friedel.
Yes. If we have any consensus at all nowadays about what an undergraduate education ought to include, I think there is consensus that it ought to include some notion of mathematics, technology, and science, as well as the humanities. The need for that is, I think, very, very strong, and the preparation for it is perhaps not necessarily the weakest, but one of the weaker parts of our high school education.
What creates this consensus? It was, we look back to 1957 and Sputnik, and that had an incredible effect on American undergraduate education. Is not to suggest necessarily a parallel, but what is it that's creating a consensus in education, or the desired consensus in education today? Is it computers?
Listen to deans who come in. We had a group of six deans, small Midwestern colleges, come in the other day.
This was at the National Endowment.
Endowment for the Humanities. And they said that part of it was, I think, just a sense of frustration at, their word, fragmented curriculum, that the curriculum is just, it wasn't a curriculum. It was just a group of faculty members, each doing his own thing, going in a variety of directions, and that the menu, I think maybe would be the word than curriculum, was frustrating to the administration at the institution, and frustrating the students. Students couldn't sort it out. Can we do any better than just assembling 50 talented people and telling them do your own thing? It was that that kind of frustration, I think, that gave rise to it.
Franklin Vort.
I think that we shouldn't get through this discussion without some reference to the need to hammer some at the faculty about the range of obligations they've taken on in accepting university college teaching positions. One of them, obviously, is to be first-rate scholars in their own field and to teach each of those fields as well as he or she can. But there's also the obligation to tell the students, if necessary, that part of our job here is to define the curriculum and to try to help you locate the things which will benefit your education. That it isn't an obligation that can simply be shucked aside for popularity.
Well, Franklin, that seems like such an obvious point. Why would the students argue against it? Why would the faculty members not desire to do that sort of thing?
Many of them do, of course, but I think the consensus in some institutions, for brief periods at least, has been almost total deference on the part of the faculty, for whatever reason, to rather transitory enthusiasm of the students. And I have three particular dangers in mind in that regard. We talk a lot about student input, and I think we all believe it's important. There are many ways of its affecting its work, the best being through a responsive and sensitive faculty and good student representatives. But there are some dangers, one of which is the they're all common sense propositions I'm offering, that if you just say, we will listen to student opinion without saying carefully how you're going to get it, you will almost inevitably get extreme student opinion. You'll get raves and you'll get outspoken and not very responsible criticism, because highly motivated people are more likely to be, probably more likely to be negative and positive, but that doesn't matter so much as the tendency toward the extremes, with the result that in some of these cases, I think the bulk of the student body end up feeling quite unrepresented. The second point is that students, even the best of them, have a relatively short-term involvement in the institution, and it's very easy to get in the position of legislating reforms demanded by graduating seniors, which are intensely unpopular with the student body a year or two later. And finally, I think there's probably no worse menace to the faculty's performance in general than the oversensitivity to sheer popularity. We're not running popularity contests for faculty, and the first sign of that coming, I think, is bad news for the whole institution.
Ernie Friedel?
Yes, there used to be a culture of the professor that included an assumption that you were responsible to your students as well as to your colleagues. And the development of universities and graduate programs has led to what David Riesman, I guess, Franklin, you remember, called the David Riesman called them the cosmopolitans versus the locals, as the professors who are cosmopolitan are trying to please the other professionals, their colleagues, in their own fields. The locals were people who were trying to establish a reputation and get their sense of self-esteem from the local community. With the increase in universities and graduate programs, you have more professors who are cosmopolitans and whose interest both in the students and in the actual management and housekeeping in universities has gone down. Now, besides that, you have a tendency for administrators to reward the research more than the teaching. Certainly the research is easier to quantify and to get quality, an understanding of quality from than the teaching is. And so the movement is toward this cosmopolitan kind of view. That's a shift, and one of its results is that the culture of the professor as a person who is part of an institution that includes a very important core of undergraduate education and views his or her responsibility as running the institution and teaching the students as well as the responsibility to the research community has been lost. That is, that sense has been lost, and perhaps we ought to be working on the culture of the professor and analyze what the professors are doing and ask the same questions about the professors that we're asking about undergraduates.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about the aims and quality of undergraduate education in the United States today. The panelists for Soundings are Sam Williamson, William Bennett, Franklin Ford, and Ernestine Friedel. Sam Williamson is a professor of history and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. William Bennett is chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a federal agency in Washington, D.C. Franklin Ford is a professor of history at Harvard University, where he was dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences from 1962 to 1970. Professor Ford recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a project entitled Don't Forget the Future, History and Looking Ahead. Ernestine Friedel is a professor of anthropology at Duke University, where she also serves as Dean of Arts and Sciences and Trinity College. Here is Sam Williamson.
Let me come back to two institutional things that I think suggest importance about teaching. I think improving the impact of teaching as a part of a tenure decision are much more important now than they were earlier. I think great researchers and absolutely awful teachers are not going to get tenure, I think, at many institutions, nor should they have in the past and will they in the future. And I think in that sense, you're sending important signals about the communal obligation or collegiate obligation that a person takes on. The other thing is the attention we're paying, and I suspect other institutions are, to the training of TAs in their teaching obligations, so that early on they're being acquainted with professional responsibilities. And if you had to look at one of the negative legacies of the 60s, I would argue it is the sense that graduate programs as a whole did not talk about professional responsibilities, and the professoriate who emerged from that period probably have had less awareness of that. After all, it was an enormous expansion and explosion, really, of graduate programs and people going into higher education. It's not surprising that that was one of the things neglected with regard to their preparation. But I think now we are taking a more serious interest in set of activities about TAs and what their teaching obligations are going to be, not just in the immediate program, but and part of their long-term professional life.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the computer. What do you think the computer is going to do to undergraduate education?
One thing one sees now here, not at the college level, but at school level, is that because of the computer and the emphasis on the computer, if you talk to secondary school administrators, they will tell you the one thing parents will ask at parents' night is, I hope you have good computers. This is something people can sort of latch on to and say, well, our school is good because we've got the best computer equipment. Ernie Boyer, in his book, a very good book on high school, it's called High School, says we have to be careful here that we don't invest too much confidence or resources in the computer. We want to be up to date, but we need to be careful. He reminds us of how much we said about television and how television would revolutionize education in all areas, and he argues that it really didn't revolutionize very much. The other thing is, it remains to be seen. I think any of us would be foolish to say this is exactly how the computer will change teaching. For the humanities, at least the humanities that I know best, philosophy, I have to say that I think in some ways we continue to be an affront to the computer and to technology. Essentially, I think one of the frustrations that we're experiencing now, again from the perspective of the humanities, is this tool doesn't really change, essentially, the kinds of questions which the humanities have raised from their very beginning. It may come to pass that someone will show that they have, but I have some doubts, and I think part of our frustration is that with all these tools and all this equipment, we still can't get to the bottom of certain questions that Plato and others were asking, and I'm not sure the computer is going to help ultimately in that as a tool, as an aid in research, in the teaching of foreign languages and other things. I do think it's obviously a valuable instrument. I had dissent a little bit from what I see and hear some places. It certainly doesn't strike me, I'm sorry to go on so long, people said, well, in the age of the computer, how can you still justify the humanities? I don't think there's any problem there.
Franklin, Ford?
Yeah, and one important respect, I think my general impression that the two cultures are not as far apart as C.P. Snow predicted 25 years ago they would be, has been served by the computer. That is, there is less suspicion, at least among my colleagues in history, of the scientist's methods, to the extent that the historian has begun to make some use of them in the form of the computer. Now, what I find most difficult about the issue we're now discussing is distinguishing between what seems quite clear, quite manifest, say from an historian's point of view, about the computer from those that are still very problematic. Clear is the fact that it permits storage and retrieval on a scale which no previous method even approached. That in turn has a very good effect, it seems to me, on historians' work, in that it permits them to ask with some possibility of answering questions that they would have ruled out on essentially just mechanical grounds before. It's also clear that it, in inviting that kind of further questioning, it is a broadening implement rather than a narrowing one. What I think is less clear is what kinds of changes it implies for just ways of tackling problems, ways of thinking, the results of which we can't even begin to estimate. For example, is there some loss in skipping some of the calculating methods that used to be required to get square root or to carry through a Euclidean geometric demonstration? The fact that you get the right answer quickly doesn't rule out the possibility there's been some cost, so that when the teacher wants to say, well, let's work this through stage by stage, I've had science professors complain that that is the one pedagogical problem it seemed to raise. It's also true that the basic approach of the computer, the binary approach to finding, moving toward truth, is in some ways very different from the geometric approach of the older logical methods. I shouldn't say logistic. There's a difference between saying there are always two possibilities, let's examine each of them in terms of those two and what possibilities they open up. That's very different from a syllogism, where you say if point A is within a small circle and we know the small circle is within a large circle, logically point A must be within the large circle. Those are two very different ways to use the mind.
Ernie Friedel?
I wanted to go back to the point of the C.P. Snow and the two cultures for a moment to raise what may be a different issue from when we've been talking about. And that is the absence in the discussion of the two cultures of the middle range, the social sciences, which strike me as interesting because our undergraduates, to get back to them, are clearly aware of the existence of science on the one hand and the humanities on the other. What they do not have is a sense of the social context in which their education and their lives are in which their lives exist. There is very little understanding of all of the social forces that affect what will happen to them and what indeed has happened to them and that's put them into the particular situation that they are in. Because of their view, and I think our whole culture's view of the world as being either value-laden in one sense, the humanities on that side, and technologically and scientifically related on the other, without the awareness of how both of those, the thought that goes into the humanities and the values that exist and the nature of science, are very much influenced by the development of social forces, of society and of history. The computer might help us to provide this middle dimension because the computer is going to change the way in which we do work. So my point is only that there are really three cultures and that the social science aspect of culture is the one about which we have the least explicit awareness.
Sam?
We began a discussion earlier with Franklin's article in the Harvard Magazine about today's undergraduates, are they human? And in one sense, to pick up on Ernie's point, the computer and all the stresses may indeed make the undergraduates far more human than they've ever been. They will be more adrift, more in need of some human touch. And to wrench a student out of a home and put a person as a freshman in any environment is a wrenching experience in and of itself. And the question of what institutions provide in terms of reaching out, I think institutions will find undergraduates even more vulnerable and more in need of some, for the want of a better term, tender, loving care through some device, and because they're really going to face a period of extraordinary change. And I think if anything, one single word to define what they face, it's complexity.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the aims and quality of undergraduate education in the United States today. The panelists for Soundings were William Bennett of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Franklin Ford of Harvard University, Ernestine Friedel of Duke University, and Sam Williamson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with Professor Elliot Valenstein of the University of Michigan, who will discuss his forthcoming history of psychosurgery, the subject of his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.